The issue for people that don't like the Gaelic street signs is that they're threatened by the fact that there's another language, there's another cultural identity in Scotland that they might not be able to tap into because they're not speakers. I think people get terrified when they see something that they deem to be foreign.
That was Iona Fife, and we'll hear more from them later in the show. Hello, and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Paul Malik, and on this episode, I'll be joined by Adele Merson and Andy Phillip to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Derek Healy.
Nicola Sturgeon has urged the Prime Minister to reassess the licence for the proposed Cambo oil field near Shetland and her first public intervention on the issue. In a letter to Boris Johnson, the First Minister called for a summit of the devolved nations to be convened ahead of COP26 and for UK government officials to provide clear leadership ahead of the climate talks. Up to 600 UK troops are to be deployed in Afghanistan to help Britons leave the country. Defence Secretary Ben Wallace voiced fears that Al-Qaeda could return to Afghanistan as he laid the blame for the country's latest turmoil at the door of former US President Donald Trump. Taliban insurgents are now estimated to hold more than two-thirds of the country as they continue to press their offensive. A quarter of consumers who took part in a witch poll said they feel the government is not at all open about the impact of new trade deals. More than two-thirds of respondents said they feel left in the dark about the impact post-Brexit trade deals struck by the UK government will have. The survey of more than 3,000 UK adults found 67% felt the public receives too little information from ministers about trade deals, with only 7% saying they knew the UK has a deal in place with Japan.
Thank you, Derek. Right, let's turn our attention to what's been happening closer to home this week. Adele, you have been following the story of COVID passports and the fact that our measly Scottish paper ones will not let us into attractions such as the Louvre or the Eiffel Tower if you are heading across to France this summer. Can you explain a bit more about what a COVID passport is and why we can't get in, whereas our English and Welsh cousins can?
Yes, Paul. So, as you say, in France is the first country to really go big on these kind of COVID health pass idea. There's been violent protests the last few days around their use, with obviously people having issues around civil liberties and things like that. But Scots have started to go over there since travel restrictions are eased, but when they get there, they're facing being turned away from places like restaurants, cafes, museums, because the proof of vaccine documents we have are still paper, a sort of paper certificate, and the French system requires a QR code, which is the crucial part that we lack. We don't have a QR code on our paper confirmation.
So a QR code is one of those scannable little sort of almost looks like a barcode that you see in the shops, isn't it? It's where you use your mobile phone, and everyone will have been using it for sort of track and trace if they've been going to the pubs.
Yes, as you say, people will have noticed them when they've been going to restaurants and bars in Scotland, and you have to just get your camera out and sort of scan this code, and you check in that way. It's that part that the Scottish version does not have. So the Scottish government has said they gave £600,000 to a Danish company to develop one, and it's still in development. They told me that it should launch next month, so we'll be watching out to make sure if that deadline is met. But obviously that's still weeks away, so you've got weeks of potential problems from tourists. The French government, they've also said they're looking into, it sounds quite a laborious process, if I'm honest, they're looking at how non-EU tourists who are also not English or Welsh can give documents to the French government and apply to kind of get a QR code sent to them. But the whole thing sounds quite complex, and I think many tourists wouldn't necessarily be aware that they had to kind of go about getting these things. The other option is when you're in France, you can go to a French pharmacy and you can get like a COVID test in the pharmacy, and it gives you a sort of 72-hour window. But you know, these measures are not, there's already so many hoops to jump through to go on holiday. I don't know if tourists will really want to be doing all this on top of everything else. So I think it is important that, as it stands, you know, opposition colleagues are saying that the country is lagging behind, because Wales and England, they have an NHS app which does have a QR code, so they are able to get into places in France. So I think it is imperative that we kind of catch up on that.
So did the Scottish government give a reason as to why we're lagging behind? Is it, I know they said they've farmed out to a Danish company, but I mean, it couldn't have come as a shock or a surprise that we'd need to get into the, people would want to get onto the continent this year with the restrictions lifting. Did they say it's the fault of the Danish, or is it another bureaucratic buck up that has seen us lag behind our counterparts elsewhere in the UK?
No, I think there are questions still around that, because I got only a 2-line response from the government that basically said, we're working with a company and we'll have it next month. But I think there will be questions as to, I think anybody could have seen that issues like this would have started to come around the corner, and I can't answer why that app isn't ready. I wonder if perhaps, I'm just speculating here, but I would wonder if perhaps because the Scotland's guidance has so up until this point been very much you shouldn't be going on holiday for recreational sort of purposes, you shouldn't be travelling for recreational purposes, and that's only recently changed, that maybe that's why it's just not been a priority. But as you say, it would always be known that this would have eventually reared its head. So I don't particularly know why that app isn't developed.
Is it currently just France?
Yeah, so there's France that's been identified as the main one. There's also in Norway, there's a problem where they have opened up to, it's the same situation, basically. They've opened up to English and Welsh tourists because they have the QR code. So English and Welsh tourists will not have to go through the kind of quarantine process. So Scottish people only have the paper copy, and the Norwegian government has said we're not accepting the paper copy. So at present, my understanding is they would still have to, if you were Scottish and going to Norway, you would still have to quarantine.
I mean, you as you know, living up in the northeast, quite a lot of the oil and gas industry workers will sometimes fly into Norway or land back in Norway if they've been out on a platform or a boat and spend a few days there. Is there any suggestion that they're at a disadvantage if they're not able to get out for restaurants or meals, and are sort of stuck where they are because of the sort of mess up by the Scottish government?
Sorry, in Norway, it's just the actual travel restrictions, rather than they don't seem to have followed suit from France and using it for cafes and restaurants and things like that. But yeah, there's certainly strong connections between the northeast, and I mean, you just have to go to Aberdeen Airport, and probably the only flights that have been running throughout the pandemic have been to Norway and places like that because of the kind of strong oil connection between the two countries. Another question that's related to all this is that we're no longer in the EU, so we would have automatically been part of the EU COVID vaccination passport scheme, which has been set up to sort of restore freedom of travel between all the countries in the EU. And we are no longer in the EU, so Britons are no longer part of that scheme, which I guess, if you're going further back, that's also a reason as to why we've got to where we are with this kind of difference in approach between the different countries, because we're no longer just part of this wider scheme. We have to actually come up with our own solutions. And in this case, those solutions aren't ready yet, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And Andy, how do you think this makes us look on the world stage? It's hardly the forward, outward looking European nation impression. There's not the impression given that that's what we are if we are falling at these sort of little mini obstacles every time, is it?
Aye. Well, it's not been a surprise either. This was a bit of an election issue. I remember covering before the Scottish Parliament election in May that there was a lot of pressure from opposition parties on the SNP to try and deal with what will become a sort of COVID passport problem. People weren't being able to get proof of their vaccination. This is when people were still going through the first stage of their jabs. Their second jabs are still quite a distant thought at that point, but there was clearly people were saying this is going to be an issue. We can't prove we've had our first jab. We've got to, you know, in England they were getting a paper copy at that point just to show that they'd had a jab. So we knew that there was already an issue. There was already an issue being built up for that. So it's taking an incredible amount of time to get to this stage. And again, we kind of think, well, we've been talking about this for months and it's still not ready when others are. So no, it's not a good look. But I mean, maybe we're putting the cart before the horse here, because I'm still baffled at who all these people are that are going away on holiday, to be honest. I mean, I thought when we were going into summer, we were effectively being told summer was cancelled. And I honestly can't even see what the attraction is about going away when things might go wrong and you might not get back or you might not get into everything.
Well, I suppose
find somewhere nice to go without a COVID passport.
I suppose travel and passports is the easiest thing to conjure is the idea that someone's traveling. But of course, it's a lot more than that. People will be going across to Europe to see family members and make business arrangements or plan for future events.
There's clearly stuff about business.
No, I do. I get a sense. People are starting to go on holiday now. I just see it, you know, from social media and people, you know, it's beginning to happen again. I'm the same as you. Like, I love traveling before the pandemic. I used to get ribbed all the time by people for always being away. But and I've not gone away and have no plans to this year, as far as I can tell. Because although I love traveling, I hate all the logistics and I panic. The night before I go on holiday, I panic in normal times about, do I have everything? Like, is everything set up? So the idea of all this kind of faff is just, doesn't appeal to me at all, I have to admit, either.
Surely the faff involved is enough to keep everyone in Scotland or the UK for the wee while and spend exorbitant amounts of money in our hotels and pubs at home. Now, MSPs are being asked to consider bringing in a new piece of legislation to give clarity on the official status of the Scots language in society. Earlier in the week, David McDougall spoke to Scots campaigner and musician Iona Fife to find out more about the recent resurgence of interest in Scots.
Iona, so when we think about the Scots language, I grew up speaking Scots and hearing it, but now, I mean, you would feel comfortable talking to me in Scots, but I wouldn't feel comfortable doing this interview in Scots. Is that something you hear a lot? Why do you think that is? There's a reluctance.
I think that's something that I experience all the time, especially when I'm meeting new folk and I'm not in my usual setting. I guess my usual setting is, you know, doing a gig where I'm singing in Scots. But I experience that all the time. And so many other folk do as well. It's really natural.
So I shouldn't be too hung up about it?
No, not at all, because you're experiencing your experiences of self-censoring, I guess that's the word that I would use, it comes from the social environment that you've been around. Like, if you've been abroad, if you've moved away, when I moved to Glasgow, like, I was absolutely terrified of dropping in a Scots word or Doric word on a course that I was studying Scots song in, because there was so many different folk from all over the world that, you know, if I accidentally let something slip, they would absolutely rip into me. So it's like our experiences come from the social constructs that we find ourselves in. And I think that it's really sad, but I still feel like that, especially if I'm meeting new folk or if I'm in a situation where people don't know me, I'm trying to put points across, you know, I might be in meetings or different things or discussing different topics. And I feel like as a young woman, people already didn't take me seriously. So if I was speaking naturally in Scots, you know, like I would speak to my mum and dad in, I feel like my point wouldn't be taken seriously. And that's still going through my head all the time. And if that's going through my own head, then I wonder how many other folk are feeling like that.
And it's interesting now that there's this movement, this drive to reclaim lost language heritage. And part of that is working with politicians at Holyrood. What is it you'd like to see around the status of Scots language when it comes to legislation in Parliament?
Well, Uair Vice has been campaigning for a Scots Language Act and has been constituted for around a year. But there's been people that have been fighting for this cause for several tens of years. It's just they haven't really pinpointed what they want Parliament to do. And I think that's something that Uair Vice does really well. Ultimately, we'd like to emulate what was the Gaelic Language Act of 2005. For me, on a personal level, I would like to see more people presenting in Scots. I'd like to see Scots more in the media and in broadcasting and hearing presenters that can speak in Scots. But when it comes to education, we've already got something called the SQA Scots Language Awards, which has proven to kind of narrow the attainment gap in Scotland, which is great. But ultimately, we need a Scots Language Act which fits into legislation that Scots is indeed an actual language. And then after that, we're needing something called a Scots Language Board, which would be full of people that are, you know, qualified to advise on policies in terms of education, in terms of media as well. So like a kind of a board which would, you know, have structure and would help the ministers to move forward and put Scots into policies, whether that be in education or otherwise. And I think that's really what we're needing. It's just to formalise the language. I mean, the Gaelic Language Act was put forth in like 2005 by a Labour-Lib Dem coalition, and that's been so successful in like raising the profile of Gaelic, but also giving it legitimacy.
And then the idea of a Scots language legislation, does it have that broad political support?
Well, right now, 35 out of 129 sitting MSPs have signed something called the Scots Pledge. And the Scots Pledge was literally something over the election that, you know, candidates could sign to say that they are interested in promoting the use of Scots and all of the dialects. They're interested in protecting it and down the line, formally acknowledging it with a Scots Language Act. And although only 35 out of 129 signed it that are sitting, loads more candidates signed it who weren't successful in getting a seat. I mean, unfortunately, it seems that there was loads of, you know, Tory candidates who actually signed it and were pretty happy to get involved. And then when it came to doing their oaths in Scots, they wouldn't respond to emails. So I think that's, yeah, I think it's difficult to make sure that Scots is on the political agenda, but also make sure that it's not politicised, because Scots should not be one party. You know, folk from all over the political spectrum speak Scots and use Scots. And we found that in the chamber previously, some of the best advocates for Scots and, of course, the Doric dialect of Scots have been folk like Peter Chapman, who is a Conservative MSP for the northeast of Scotland. He was a shining example of someone that wanted to promote the dialect Doric of Scots and then Scots language as a whole. So it shouldn't be politicised, but right now I'm looking at the list of MSPs that obtained their oath and affirmation in Scots, and most of them were from the SNP, people like Emma Harper, who's been an advocate for Scots, you know, for quite some time. But yeah, I'm of the opinion that it shouldn't be party political, but it should be on the political agenda, just like Gaelic.
Yeah, and we saw so many different MSPs taking their oaths in different languages, in German, in Shona, one of the official languages of Zimbabwe. But as you say, not many of them did it in Scots, despite the interest in it during the election period. One of the most contentious things about Gaelic Language Act and how it's used in practical terms every day, it's a very easy way to criticise the people who do criticise the Gaelic Language Act. They talk about, all we see is that street signs have been changed to Gaelic. And I know that there's so much more to it than that. So you touched on some of those issues that practically the Scots Language Board would deal with. But then in practical ways, every day, where would people see the effects of a Scots Language Act?
In terms of the pledge and our oaths and affirmations, in 2016, there was 4 MSPs that obtained their oaths or affirmations in Scots. And now in 2021, there was 8. So that's actually pretty good. Also, the amount of people that signed the pledge amounts to 29% of the sitting parliament. 30% of Scotland identified as speaking Scots in the 2011 census. So actually, hearing, you know, 29% of parliament want to represent Scots, which is spoken by 30% of the electorate, that's actually really good going. So that's that. I really struggle with the fact that I don't think that a Scots Language Act would spur street signs. I think that personally, it's great to have signages and have Scots be more visible, and that's brilliant. The National Library of Scotland, I think, actually put in Scots signs as well as Gaelic. That's really cool and a great step forward. But in terms of financing, that's really unrealistic. And I don't know personally for me if I want to see things like Aberdeen and then different, or Anster instead of Anster. I'm not sure if financially that's the best way to go about it. For me, I'd rather be putting more money into having Scots in the curriculum and know just for January, know just for Burns Week, you know, being able to support young speakers, harness skills in writing and reading in Scots. Because I think the issue for people that don't like the Gaelic street signs is that they're threatened by the fact that there's another language, there's another cultural identity in Scotland that they might not be able to tap into because they're not speakers. I think people get terrified when they see something that they deem to be foreign in their own country. And that's where we see people that outcry against Gaelic, as you know, people that are terrified of anything that's different to what they have experienced. And it's the same with Welsh. You know, you've got a lot of the time, unfortunately, you've got people that have got second homes in Wales, and they come over from, you know, maybe the south of England, and they go into a Welsh pub and they're shocked that people are speaking Welsh because they identify with that as a foreign language, and they feel like they're not part of something. And I understand why someone would feel threatened by a language. I get it, because they feel like they're left out. But instead of being abrasive and hating on that language and, you know, trolling and sending abuse online, why not just learn it a little? I think that for me is like indicative of why folk don't like Gaelic on street signs, because they feel like it spurs some sort of like us and them into them. But I think the Scots stigmatisation is a wee bit different in the fact that if you're a Gaelic speaker, it's quite a binary language. It's either one or zero. It's you can speak it or you can't. But then with Scots, because it's got that mutual intelligibility and the sliding scale between Scottish English and then the Scots language, folk can understand fae context fit folk are saying. And I think that that's why Scots is open to all of this abuse and trolling, being like, oh, it's no language, or you're just speaking slang, you're uneducated, you're a Ned. So having, like for me, having a language act to put into legislation that Scots is a language, and those that can speak it hey, certain skills in reading, writing, scriving, understanding, and putting forward information in Scots, whether that be songs or music, or, you know, we've been seeing politicians use Scots mair and mair in the chamber. You know, when Nicola Sturgeon says keep the heed, I think that's a brilliant analogy. And I'm sure that that sends a particular part of the political spectrum wild. Unfortunately, I just don't think it should be party political. And it's really sad the way that Scots has went, and the fact that there's so many folk that are willing to just bringe in and abuse people that use Scots online.
And I think if people want to learn a little bit more about this, I can thoroughly recommend Alistair Heather's documentary. Probably find it on BBC's iPlayer, called Rebel Tongue, which came out last year. And he highlighted that there were no Scots language signs in Parliament. So maybe that's going to be a first step. Iona Fife, thank you so much for joining us today.
Cheers. No bother.
Thank you, Iona and David. Right. Now, we have other issues to be talking about this week. And I think probably one of the biggest stories in Scottish politics right now is the proposed deal between the SNP and the Greens, which would see them go into a sort of, well, not a sort of coalition, but would see them go into coalition at Holyrood. We've heard murmurs over the summer break as to how that's going to come about and who's going to go where and whether or not we will see Green MSPs as ministers. But I think the most glaring example was a letter sent earlier this week from the First Minister to the Prime Minister regarding the Cambo oil field. Now, if you're interested in what the Cambo oil field is all about and the specific details about it, please listen to our sister podcast or cousin podcast. Not quite sure which family member it is, but it is in our stable of podcasts, Energy Voice, which is available now on all good podcast providers. Andy, you've been looking up and speaking to people behind the scenes of the potential deal between the two independent supporting parties at Holyrood. Can you give us a little bit more background as to what the SNP Green coalition could bring about?
Nicola Sturgeon announced that talks were underway for talks about talks at the end of May, shortly after the election, in which both parties said that they weren't actually thinking about coalitions. So it has been a long process. The talks about talks, looked into whether this was even like a, you know, something that will get off the ground. Then they sort of whittled it down into areas that they might find common ground on. But none of this is all going on behind the scenes, and to the point where people in the party don't really know what leadership we have been talking about. I mean, we wrote about this the other day about how nervous SNP MSPs were having a sort of hastily arranged meeting to hear from Nicola Sturgeon, John Swinney, and anybody else about what this is going to be, because they're going to have to sell it back to their constituents. We've all been, I guess, looking to sort of fill the vacuum and say, well, what is it? What's the point of all of this? And obviously energy, oil, the climate change conference coming up in November, the climate emergency, these are all major issues which we assume and expect that an SNP Green pact agreement, coalition, whatever form it takes, is going to have to address, whether that means putting Green MSPs in government, which is what Nicola Sturgeon signalled straight away that, you know, it could be the result. What does that mean? The Labour Lib Dem coalition in previous Scottish administrations, it was really formalised and had a Lib Dem as a deputy. I mean, I can't see a Green MSP shoving John Swinney to one side. So do they carve out a new brief for a Green member, or do they change the sort of deck chairs a little? I mean, I also can't see Nicola Sturgeon firing someone she only appointed from her own party into government, you know, a few weeks back. So yeah, it's with civil servants now. There's a lot of detail to be fleshed out, but the headlines on energy, climate change, and domestic policy more rather than, well, that's actually another point. We have focused a lot on oil and gas, but a lot of that at the high level is reserved to Westminster. So we'd be very interested to see what they actually have as a practical set of policies that will differ from what the SNP government or Green Party had in their manifestos in the first place.
And it's probably fair to say that the SNP haven't traditionally always been the most environmentally forward-thinking party, you know, basing a lot of the calculations on Scottish independence off the use and back and money raised by oil and gas, which is a big no-no for the Greens, even though they both support independence. Do you think this is a fundamental shift in the SNP policy, or do you think this is maybe just a little stick and plaster that they're putting on so that they can secure enough of a majority to bell ring for a second independence referendum further down the line?
Like it's almost an existential thing. I mean, it is remarkable that 6 years or 7 years ago, we were effectively being told that our future as an independent state was underpinned by high oil revenues. And in a remarkable short period of time, the SNP said, well, it was a mistake to bake those calculations in. We'll look at a more sober, long-term economic case. That's come and gone without a referendum to sort of sell it. And now it's all about, well, how can we get away from oil and gas? So it is remarkable, really. And you can see among people within the SNP, particularly in the Northeast, there is clearly some anxiety and a bit of nerves about, well, what have we done to actually get the renewable jobs or the alternative jobs and revenue in place in time? I mean, how fast can we possibly go? And the Greens are really pushing. They want a quick timetable. So is anyone ready? You know, are the jobs there? This is where it starts to become not so much an abstract issue about potential oil fields, potential deals. It's going to be hit with a real dose of reality very, very soon.
And what's the feeling up in the Northeast, up in Aberdeen and Aberdeenshire? Is there a sense that there are plenty of jobs for people to go into if oil and gas comes crumbling down?
No. That's a simple answer.
Yeah.
Certainly from living here, it really is hard to explain unless you're from here. But if you live here, every single person you know will have either they work in the oil industry themselves, or their parents, their partner, their children will work in it. And you know, just myself, I've got my dad was in it, my brother's in it, friends' husbands are in it, my friends are engineers, and it's just, it's hard to imagine. And these are, you know, skilled, intelligent people. And I spoke to my friend who's an engineer, and I said to her, she doesn't really follow politics particularly, and I was kind of speaking to her about this idea of a, you know, the kind of energy transition and net zero and things, and she had a very vague awareness of it and kind of said, yeah, like, you know, I'd be really up for, very, very keen to go into renewables, because, to, you know, it's a growing industry. Nobody probably wants to think they're in an industry that is being talked about being wound down and things. But in terms of, I asked her, like, do you have any idea how you go about doing that? And she doesn't have the slightest clue how, you know, it's never been, it's not something that on the ground, your day-to-day energy work, oil and gas worker knows about what it really means in practice, if that makes sense. So there's all these words and all these phrases about the energy transition, but in terms of the kind of the employees up here, I don't think they know what that means for their own futures, their own careers, their own like jobs. I think that, as Andy just said there, we're now at the stage where we need to start seeing concrete what that means on the ground, how people will go from one career to the other and kind of use the transferable skills that they will have. Because as far as I can see, there's not the evidence that the jobs are there yet, which I think is the, that's the criticism kind of being leveled. Like, people are saying that, yes, we understand that the climate crisis means that we have to move away from fossil fuels, but we can't just, we still have a need for fossil fuels at the moment. We haven't got to the stage where there's no sort of domestic need for oil. So the criticism is that, well, will we just end up kind of closing down everything and then we just import oil from other places? That doesn't make sense. So there's definitely some real things that need to be thrashed out here before we can really move forward on it, I think. And, you know, the Conservatives, the Northeast is probably the one part of Scotland where they have real, still have, you know, real support. And I think the SNP will be mindful of thinking that they don't want to almost just hand this to the Conservatives. It's something the Conservatives, you can see, are jumping on already, and they've made a lot of it that this could lead to, well, their claims are that it could lead to thousands of job losses and things. That's what they think, but they're clearly trying to make political capital out of it, if you know what I mean. And the SNP will want to be mindful of how they kind of combat that.
I mean, that was what I was going to ask next, Adele. I mean, in terms of politically speaking, if you're an SNP supporter up in the Northeast, you probably assume that they're looking out for the oil and gas industry as their number one concern, whereas the Greens haven't ever hidden the fact that they want to close the oil and gas industry down. They have said that they want to transfer the jobs and make sure that it's a just transition. I should point out, you know, they don't just want to, or they haven't just been saying close the gates and just leave the workers out to rot. But political deals in Aberdeen and Aberdeenshire haven't exactly gone down well recently. I would see the example of the Aberdeen 9 as a case of that. How would a deal between the Greens and the SNP go down to sort of the general populace in Aberdeen? Do you think it would be popular, or do you think all hell would break loose?
I don't think all hell would break loose. I think it's probably, to be honest, if you went out in Aberdeen city centre right now and asked people, I could be wrong, but I don't think it's something sort of the coalition between the two parties is really keeping them up at night or anything far from it. But I think to be fair, on both sides, sort of extreme statements aren't helping, because at the end of the day, it is people's livelihoods and jobs. And I think it's on both, you know, both the Conservatives and the SNP and Greens to, you know, they have to just sit down and think how, I think everyone knows that we have to transition away from fossil fuels, but it's really like differences in language and differences in the speed of that transition and how that transition will work that needs to be really hammered out now. Because yeah, it's not nice for oil and gas workers, I'm sure, to kind of open a newspaper and see all these kind of, oh, it could be thousands of jobs going, if that is not the case. So we really need to try and come up with a path forward, I think, so that that doesn't happen.
So Andrew Bowie might be over-egging it a wee bit by saying that the Greens are holding a knife to the situation. Is that maybe a bit extreme? I'd say that's maybe a bit extreme. Given the current climate, probably words that a parliamentarian shouldn't really be using.
Yeah. See on that, though, there was a, you know, the oil industry itself has been highlighting the number of jobs that have gone. We've been through, you know, without specifically talking about a transition and climate emergency. The, you know, there was the downturn, then there was the oil prices went down, and then there's the pandemic, and there's many jobs gone. And if you speak to them, they also say how they're on board. They want to get to this sort of, you know, fabled land of net zero or whatever that is. And so it's not just about being scared of losing one industry. There is, I think, a lot of good debate and discussion going on about how that inevitably will change. I mean, everyone, like Adele just said, everyone does know that there is a serious environmental problem going on all around us right now. And we've been, you know, I would encourage folk to check out some of the other kind of opinion pieces that we've been carrying on our pages recently. I was just looking at some of them. We mentioned Andrew Bowie today, which is a very, very partisan and pointed piece today, very politically motivated. But there's plenty others of people, including former SNP advisors, talking about what this means for the SNP and Greens. Is this greenwash for the SNP? Is it a bit of prestige for the Greens, or are they really going to do something interesting in a position of power if they get that? Something we carried from a guy called James McKenzie, who used to work for the Greens in the Scottish Parliament, talking about carbon capture and all these, and how he says that, you know, the best form of carbon capture is just to leave the oil and gas undrilled. There's lots of stuff. There's lots of food for thought in there. And I think, as Adele mentioned, that the people in the oil industry recognise all these competing problems as they, you know, they go to work and wonder, well, what's coming next. And I think that the key thing here will be if the SNP and Green Pact is put together in a way that people will understand and they can demonstrate what it is they're going to do, rather than just being, there's going to be a climate change conference in November and we'll try and hitch the bandwagon to that.
And in terms of how this could swing or sway or convince Westminster that there should be a second independence referendum, and if we might just have to look at this quickly because we're running short on time. Andy, how do you think, first of all, that could play out? Do you think it's more or less likely that we will have a referendum in this term of Parliament if the Greens and the SNP come to a deal?
The independence side of all this has really been sidelined, has it not? Yeah. I mean, in the run-up to the election, it was a big issue. The SNP and Greens together have a pro-independence majority at Holyrood, but you know, you look back to they also said that, I think that doesn't really, it has to be reflected in the polls as well before anyone who's opposed to independence is going to start to sit up and notice. At the moment, I can't see anything changing. It will cement their pro-independence majority, but Boris Johnson's not going to change his mind. The polls aren't going up dramatically for independence, and the SNP, well, Nicola Sturgeon doesn't want to have a referendum tomorrow. So I'm not really sure if it brings us any closer to a sort of crunch moment on that at all. I think that they'll be both quite keen to show that there's a pro-independence majority, but deal with the pressing issues now first.
And Adele, do you think we'll see a referendum before the end of this parliament, or do you think it's all quiet on that front?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. I think it remains to be seen, but I certainly, it does feel like independence isn't, you know, we've just spoken there at length about the climate crisis. It seems like there's other climate crisis and coronavirus are kind of pushed up in the agenda, and it kind of remains to be seen once that start, you know, we are starting to get into more normality with coronavirus and going back to trying to go back to some level of normality. So that, you know, priorities can change quickly. Maybe we start to go back to normality and all of a sudden that debate very much ramps up. But I think for at least the next couple of years, it's maybe going to be not quite at the forefront.
Well, nobody tell Alex Salmond that no one's interested in independence in that case. Right, I think that is all that we have time for. Thanks to Adele and Andy, producer Chris, and of course you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, and even after, pick up or log on to the Courier, the Press and Journal, and all of our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.